and welcome to the Strange Horizons podcast. This is Susan Grappi, the editor-in-chief of Strange Horizons. I know we had a podcast before. We had good intentions of having a podcast before. However, the podcast that we had before basically just duplicated exactly what you can get in our online newsletter, which if you go to our site, www.strangehorizons.com, and look at the bottom of that main page, there's a little box there where you can put your email address in, and once a week you will get an email update notifying you of our new content and telling you what it is. Given that we have an email newsletter that does that, there wasn't a whole lot of point in having a podcast version of that. The email newsletter actually includes links, which I can't do when I'm talking to you. So that was not the best idea for a podcast. What we're doing instead here, I want you to think of this as our reinvented, reimagined, relaunched Strange Horizons podcast. In this reinvented podcast, from time to time, I will be interviewing or having a conversation with Strange Horizons authors, staff members, other people of interest. So that's the new podcast, and it will be a lot more fun to produce, hopefully a lot more fun to listen to, and will feel like it has a point. So on that note, I would like to welcome you to this first of our new podcast series. What we have for you today is a conversation with author Benjamin Rosenbaum. Ben's story, The House Beyond Your Sky, which was published in Strange Horizons in September 2006, is on the ballot this year for the Hugo Award for Best Short Story. This is the first Strange Horizons story to be on the Hugo ballot, although I should note it's not Ben's first appearance on the Hugo ballot. A couple of years ago, his story, and the full title of the story is Biographical Notes to A Discourse on the Nature of Causality with Airplanes by Benjamin Rosenbaum, and that's the full title. That story, which originally appeared in All-Star Zeppelin Adventure Stories, was a Hugo nominee a couple of years ago. But as I said, House Beyond Your Sky is the first Strange Horizons story to receive a Hugo nomination, and we could not be more thrilled. Ben has actually published a number of stories in Strange Horizons, including the Other Cities series, which was collected as a chapbook from Small Bear Press. He's been published in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, in Harper's Magazine, and in McSweeney's, and he has a collection coming out next year from Small Bear Press. I spoke to Ben earlier today. He lives in Basel, Switzerland at the moment, so I believe it was around sort of dinner time, his time, fairly early morning my time. We had a couple of technical problems with the call. I've tried to smooth some of that out in the editing, but if there are any places that sound particularly broken or jumpy, that's places where we lost the call and had to pick up again. So with that, I should get to the interview / conversation with Benjamin Rosenbaum, conducted earlier today. Hope you enjoy. Oh, God, should I do one of those little, like, interviewee, intro-y things?
I guess.
I'm here today on the podcast with Benjamin Rosenbaum. I'm not very good at that part.
I think you should have the part at the beginning where you go, oh, should I do one of those little interviewee things?
And then I guess
you could also record the intro later.
That's true.
We spoke with
earlier this morning at my kitchen table. That was part. I actually had to move into the kitchen because the wireless signal has been kind of flaky in my office, which is, I find that unfortunate that the room where I actually work has less reliable wireless than the kitchen. But
right. Probably if nothing... if you had the right physics geeks around, you could just, like, you know, put a strip of tinfoil down or something. do the right.
Yeah. So
reflections of things.
Okay, so I have a list of stuff that I would like to ask you about, but And the first one actually is the Anthroptic Project.
Uh-huh.
Because you mentioned that you and Ethan have an art show coming up, and could you talk a little about that? Because that sounds really cool.
We have an art show in New York. It's like a gallery show. This whole project has been really fascinating for me because I'm used to the world of fiction is sort of like the price is fixed of a given thing, and you try to sell as many of them as possible. So, you know, that economics gives kind of the whole feeling of the thing. So you submit something and they like it and they go, oh, let's like sell lots of these. And so being in the high art world where there's a whole, this has a whole different historical provenance and everything, it's very odd for them to to buy your work and go, okay, we're only making 80 of these ever. Like, there will only be ever 80. You know, that seemed very weird.
Yeah, I can see that.
A signed limited edition, so there's kind of artificial scarcity, which is particularly funny in because this project is so, you know, extremely digital. I mean, we also put it on the web, which makes it even funnier. So you can read the whole story on the web, but then if you want, there's like the 80 signed limited edition copies of the original like Anthroptic thing, which is actually not ridiculous because they put so much effort into the craft of making it. There's like they're like insanely archival, you know,
right.
They'll like be there after the nuclear war. Yeah, well,
so, but what exactly is the original art piece?
Ethan did a series of he's interested in I don't know if well he's interested in he's a conceptual artist lately, I guess, and he's interested in he does a lot of really interesting sort of thought provoking stuff. And one thing he was interested in was you know, before photography, there was this whole idea that, you know, the reproduction of exact life was like a good thing for painters to do. They tried to, you know, get things down. And then, you know, the machine automated that. So there was a debate with photography for survival, like, is photography an art? You know, could that be an art? The machine's doing all the work. And the point, you know, that I believe that it is now reasonably settled that photography is an art, because even though the machine is doing the reproduction, the human being is doing the selection. So right. Ethan was interested in doing and taking that one step further and doing something where the machine would also do the selection.
Interesting.
So he had a project called Self-Portrait. And what he did is he took some facial recognition software of the kind that, you know, if you walk through an airport, tries to decide that you're a terrorist or, you know, whatever. And he loosened up the parameters, I think, to make it more, you know, to make it work better. And then he set it loose on Flickr. He trained it, you know, it's like a sort of neural net. He trained it on his photograph, and then he set it loose on Flickr to find copies of himself. I think he was aware, you know, at the time, I don't think there were any pictures of him on Flickr. So, you know, it basically found all these false positives.
So he was looking for Flickr pictures that the computer thought were him but weren't.
Exactly. So Flickr pictures and the idea was this was a self-portrait. It is a self-portrait composed of pictures other people took that the computer thinks looked like him.
That's cool.
So you know, it's very funny. And you look at these, so I went and looked at this site, and you look at these, and it's very interesting because they don't look all we wouldn't, you know, a human being wouldn't say these all look like Ethan, you know? There's one that sticks out of my mind, which is this little blonde 8-year-old girl who's kind of looking straight at the camera. And, you know, Ethan's, you know, a guy in his 30s. But they both have glasses. I mean, they're sort of interestingly, you sort of have this feeling like, yes, in a sense, she does look like Ethan. You know, obviously, if you were given a book of photographs and you were asked, you know, pick ones that look like Ethan, you would not pick an 8-year-old girl.
Right.
You know, but like, you're like, well, in a sense, so there, you know, it's you almost get the sense of, even though what the machine is doing is relatively simple operations, it has to do with, like, the distance apart of the pupils and so on, but you get this sense of there being almost a personality, you know, almost this robot is sort of almost a... you know, it's doing its best to find Ethan, and it has a taste. You know, I mean, it's a simple program, but it has a certain aesthetic. You know,
right.
What it considers, how it, you get a window into how it thinks, sort of.
I was gonna say you're calling it aesthetics, but I think, you know, it could just as easily be called parameters.
Yeah. Perhaps all aesthetics could be called parameters. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, that's
it's
interesting.
I mean, I'm not trying to make an argument that this, you know, that this 100-line, you know, program or whatever it is, you know, is sentient. But I think it's interesting because it's all the ways that people look at things. It's not that the computer is very sophisticated in any other regard, but it is doing one task which humans do, which is recognize faces. And because
and
when it does it well, it's hard to distinguish it from the way humans do it. But when it makes errors, it makes different errors than the ones humans would make. Mm-hmm. And that gives you this sort of triangulation, so where you get to see sort of how we see is limited in a way. Because, anyway, so Ethan called me up after he did this self-portrait project, and he said he wanted to do another project. He wanted to commission or, you know, collaborate with me and have me write stories to go with the pictures, and we kicked around a bunch of ideas. He ended up sending me a bunch of photographs where the computer had falsely identified a face. Because the first step is the computer figures out where the face is, you know,
right.
And it draws a little box, and then it tries to figure out if that face is Ethan. There was a bunch of places where it was drawing a box around something that's not actually a face. Or it's a face which isn't really a face, like a, you know, or it's a cat, or it's a face in a photo, in a, you know, that's just shadows on a mountain. You know, somewhere this thing is. Those it struck me as very evocative, and I looked through and I selected a bunch of those. So then I wrote a suite of 8 short stories that are all kind of on the topic what's the topic? they're all related to this. The frame tale is that there is about this robot who's kind of, okay. You know, who I eventually came to see is kind of doomed. You know, he's sort of stuck with the situation of having to, he's stuck with the situation of having to, you know, this task that's not really possible to do. You know, he's looking for faces.
Okay, so the robot is out looking for people and coming.
The robot is looking for faces and finding faces where there are not. And it's you know, much like us, the robot is like not sufficiently equipped to do the job it has been tasked by the universe. You know, it's sort of fumbling around, and that gave me a lot of sympathy for this robot. So and it's interesting all the places that the robot fails. So anyway, I wrote a suite of, you know, unrelated stories, some of which are very kind of contemporary, like guy meets a girl in a bar, should she trust him? Some of which are like, you know, flowers have actually been running, you know, controlling the human race for 10,000 years. You know, they were kind of all over the map genre-wise.
Right.
And they all linked together in one way or another. And okay. And so then there was a boxed edition, like I said, a sort of limited edition of these made
only
for a subscription service. It's called The Present Group, which is a neat, like you could pay $150 a year and you get like 4 times a year like these original artworks by contemporary artists.
Oh,
we were the debut one.
Wow.
And it was just really fascinating to see the high art world. So now we have this gallery show in New York, and so Ethan's made these big reproductions of these photographs, and he's getting professional voice actors to record my stories. And so you can, you know, you go and you call on your cell phone. I think you go look at the picture and you call your cell phone, you call a number that's printed on the label, and you hear the story. And
that's cool.
It's the whole thing is very funny to me. I mean, one thing that's really funny is, so there's one picture that's like, it's a picture of it's a picture where the face that the computer found is a face which is in a stencil on some graffiti on a wall in like Chile. And then I wrote a story, having no idea who the actual guy in the stencil is, wrote a story, you know, speculating who he might be and why you would. He's sort of a sort of bland bureaucratic looking guy, and it's sort of the spark for the story is why would you do this act of like flagrant civil disobedience and like, you know, like instead of Che Guevara, use this kind of bespectacled, you know, middle-aged bureaucrat. Like,
right.
what world would generate, you know? And of course, I don't know. There is a real reason answer to it, but I wasn't interested in the real answer.
Right.
So in this, there's this kind of this bureaucrat Vreeder who presides over the central bank at the time when money is sort of spiraling down and not being used anymore. He's like the last, you know, he ushers in the age of no money anymore, and
and thus becomes a symbol for graffiti.
Yeah, and so he's considered kind of a hit. There's a hagiography. There's a whole, you know, revolutionary mythos around him. And the story is written from the perspective of a historian who's kind of, you know, sort of snide about this whole, you know, way in which it has been exaggerated. His reader's influence has been exaggerated and, you know, kind of has to grudgingly grant him some credit, but basically is, you know, trying to make the point that, you know, this has been blown out of proportion by the popular tradition around
right.
the bureaucrat. I thought that was funny. Anyway, but the funny thing about this extra textually is that you have this photograph that Ethan is, you know, selling in the gallery, and it's so there was a guy who was the original model for this, then there was somebody who made a stencil, and then there was somebody who stenciled the graffiti on the wall, and then there was some photographer who took his picture and put it on. And then Ethan's robot found the picture.
Right.
And that, you know, sort of very Duchampian. We actually tracked down all the people. They were all Creative Commons. I mean, Creative Commons sort of enabled us to do this whole project because there, you know, there are the, you know, you can actually look on Flickr and say which photos can I use in an art project.
Right.
But so we actually tracked down all the people who took the original photos and, you know, sent them some money and said, hey, thanks. But it was just very there's this whole many layers of like authorship that.
Yeah. I love the idea that or I don't know if I love it, I think there's something interesting about the idea of a gallery show where people are going to be going around and calling something on their cell phones. I mean, I haven't been to many art gallery shows, but I know at museums, they have those audio tour things sometimes. I went to there was an exhibit at the Oakland Museum of California a couple years ago on treasures from the Forbidden Palace. So it was a sort of art and history kind of thing.
Huh?
And they had they were giving, normally you have to pay for the audio tour, but they were giving it free. So it was really in a museum, which I think of as a kind of social experience. I mean, I was there with a friend, and everyone in the museum, in these galleries, is wearing sort of headphones and walking around holding their little, you know, and it's, right. and it, it's, it was a the controller for the headset, for, you know, for the tour, you would get to a place and then push a button. You would say, now push this button, you know. So it was kind of like the way you had a social experience was by sort of looking at each other and pushing the button at the same time. So you knew at least you were in your own little headset world listening to the same thing. And so I think, again, I mean, but the typical like movie and TV portrayal of art gallery shows is, again, it's very social. It's people walking around with glasses of wine and flirting. And
I think that's,
instead,
I think
they're all going to be.
And then if you come after the opening, then everybody's sort of, you know, sketching or whatever.
But then walking around on their cell phones, listening to.
Is funny, particularly at the opening, it would be particularly ironic that everyone is supposed to be hobnobbing in there.
Right.
Got cell phones. I mean, that's a good point. It will be funny to see how that works, and I don't know whether, I mean, the other option, I suppose, would have been to have, like, a button you push, and then it's, like, audio broad, you know, like, then there's the, you know, everyone hears it at the same time. You've got to show up and wait. That would be more social.
Well, but it's also, I mean, having heard a lot of those in museums, too, there are problems with that, and, you know, people walk in midway through and don't hear the whole thing. And
It's a good question. I don't know. The curatorial aspects are somewhat out of my area. But it should
be interesting. I want to jump back a little to the Creative Commons licensing, because that was actually another thing on my list of stuff I wanted to talk to you about. We've recently, as you know, we've recently offered Creative Commons licensing to all of our authors at Strange Horizons. And one of the reasons we did that was that you asked us to on some of your stories. So you were the first person to ask, and then one or two other authors came to us about it, and we decided, you know what, why not offer everyone this? I mean, you guys have that option anyway with your work on our site, but just let everyone know they have the option.
I mean, it's much like Flickr, sort of. What's nice about Flickr is you can kind of check a box and say, what rights do I want to reserve on this image? You know, it's almost a matter of user interface, right?
Right, exactly.
And that's, I believe you're the first fiction publishing site that does that, that lets you say, what rights would you like to put this under?
That, well, as far as we know, we're the first. I think,
and it's not surprising,
given
the degree of, you know, you guys have a very high degree of sort of sophistication in process workflow, you know. Maybe by necessity, because you have lots of scattered around volunteer staff, right? So, but that means it's, you could tell that, like, most places you submit, there's a stack of moldering manuscripts and somebody, you know, hurriedly looking through them. And you could, you know, that it's really interesting. It's like, there's a database, and so there's gender statistics, and there's, you know,
exactly
time to, you know, you can get enormous amounts of number crunching going on of, like, how many on average, Jed's always like, median time for submission response is currently 1.41 days.
And we actually have our sort of internal statistics, and, you know, this is our third highest week, you know, for August's ever or something.
Right.
Just kind of like at baseball games, they put up statistics a lot on the scoreboard, and some of them seem kind of arcane, like third highest home run hitter for players born in South Dakota or something.
For players born in South Dakota. Baseball is clearly attracts a lot of statistics geeks who,
The game lends itself to statistics.
But on
the Creative Commons thing, I mean, you're looking over your sort of bibliography, and you have a lot of your work under Creative Commons license. And you're certainly not the only author in science fiction to be doing that. But it's the sense of sort of Creative Commons versus holding more tightly to your copyright kind of thing is it's a really contentious issue for writers these days. And you seem to be just very kind of uncomplicatedly jumping out front and saying, we're letting this work go into the world. And you've actually posted on your website that you would love for people to, you know, remix and reuse your stories.
Yeah.
And I just, that is, I think it's neat. It's also not the most common kind of attitude. So, I mean, where does that come from for you?
I don't know. Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, people have, you know, widely varying views on that. I guess it just sort of feels like, I mean, I could probably come up with a lot of sophisticated, you know, kind of intellectualized reasons, but those would probably be boring because you've probably heard them before. I mean, that's sort of, you know, they'd mostly be cribbed from Corey anyway. But I think that emotionally, you know, I have never had the experience. You know, I mean, I had a little story published in Harper's at one point, the called The Orange, and it was in Harper's, and it wasn't ever online. It was only in the print Harper's. And so, like, every year or so, like, two sort of high school students will, like, laboriously copy it and put it in their blog. Like, and they'll say, The Orange by Benjamin Rosenbaum. They'll type the whole thing, and they'll go, wow, isn't this cool? And, you know, I was, and at the beginning, when I didn't know very much about, you know, and I hadn't educated myself very much about intellectual property, property, and I had only sort of heard like the, I don't know, the sort of general superficial presentation that you get. I had for some reason the sense like, oh my gosh, I should really be telling these people like not to do this. And that just was so depressing because like some 16-year-old has like taken their whole, you know, like taken like, you know, 20 minutes to like type this thing out of an old, like a 3-year-old issue of Harper's into their blog. Like, who, wait, that's, what a pain to like, what, you know, what a party pooper you have to be to go and go, you know, you really have to ask for permission before, you know, I mean, what the hell, you know? So incredibly flattering, you know, and it's very nice to think of people propagating. And in some ways, it's sort of like they're doing, you know, they're, I mean, you know, obviously it depends on what you want. And if you don't want that, it you know, I'm not, for somebody for whom that was very troubling when their work appeared, then I, you know, that it wouldn't be very nice for them. But on the other hand, for, you know, for me, it's like they're doing work for me. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, you know, if somebody goes and translates the story or turns a story into, you know, or puts it, you know, if a story hasn't been put on the web in digital format and somebody, you know, goes and does that, it's sort of like, well, they're doing that for me. You know what I mean? Sort of feel grateful. I mean, exposes that to a new audience who wouldn't have read it before. You know, and it's, that's the kind of the emotional perspective. I've never, it's always wonderful when someone takes something that I've done and like does something with it. And I particularly love, I mean, I've sort of been begging people to like go and like riffs on and versions of my work. And I mean, that hasn't very much happened. There was, actually your founder, Marianne, wrote a poem based on Start the Clock as part of the original, Exquisite Corpuscle project. I think it's eventually going to come out now, I've heard.
Yeah. People listening may not know about this.
There was a story I wrote called Start the Clock, which was about a bunch of, it's about the outbreak of a virus which stops chronological aging so that, you know, people, you know, normally for normal human beings, you know, you get to 11, 12 years old, you hit puberty, you know, various things, you know, all these developmental changes happen, you know, your whole life in your brain and so on, which, you know, kind of shape your experience of things. Being 9 is different than being 6. There's a virus breaks out that stops aging. So people are 9, you know, they're in 9-year-old bodies for 30 years. So the story is about what kinds of lives they would live, you know, what lifestyles they have. And in the story, it's about 30 years after the outbreak of the virus, and it becomes possible to start the clock again, to restart the biological aging process. And, you know, this obviously generates a lot of controversy for the characters about whether they should or not, because in some ways it's nice to be 9 forever. And of course, they're not really 9.
And to be 9 forever.
What's that?
Right. And it's not, they're not just kids. I mean,
no, they're,
in many ways they are kids, but they have the financial resources and sort of rights of adults.
Yeah, so a lot of the story was about speculating, you know, a lot of the writing of the story was about speculating which parts of being 40 have to do with having lived 40 years, and which parts have to do with having, you know, the biological brain that a 40-year-old has now, you know. And so there's ways in which I think, you know, I mean, not, it was, I picked 9s for the story because I think by 9 you have a pretty sophisticated set of cognitive functions. I think at 5, you know, however long you're 5, you are going to end up being thinking very differently, you know, and there some cognitive developmental things may just not be there. At 9, you know, you're basically lacking in information, but in some ways I think you're probably, I mean, certainly the younger, you know, the 9s are much better at learning languages than, you know, than adults. I mean, there's lots of ways in which they're smarter, and then there's ways in which they maybe lack certain, but you know, they're interesting cognitive differences as you age. But, you know, and I mean, the idea is actually that the 9s end up being a kind of a rich group because they're very competitive. They're not distracted because they don't have a lot of, you know, they're pre-sexual and they don't have a lot of other things to spend their time. They're sort of like all the ultimate geeks. I mean, if you hang around 9-year-olds at all, they're very competitive. They're very interested in problem solving and they're very sort of you know, obsessive about things. So it's like they make great like geeks. You know, they make great computer programmers and biologists once they've had a college education, right? Because I mean, you know, they have 20 years to pick up the skills. So they and the people who are really screwed are the teenagers who end up being kind of an urban underclass. They are you know, they're kind of discriminated against, and also, you know, because I mean, they're suffering from like teenage, you know, acne and growth hormones and risk taking behaviors for, you know, 30 years.
Yeah. That doesn't sound fun.
No. So anyway, but it's interesting how it fractures society into the idea is that it fractures society. And, you know, the Nines, for instance, they don't really do the whole, I mean, they don't, the traditional model of, like, the finding, you know, being single meaning finding a mate and therefore having kids and so on, that doesn't really make any sense to them. They don't have the equipment. So they end up having this much, much more sort of Peter Pan Lost Boys-like lifestyle in which they, you know, they group into packs of, like, you know, 5 to 10 and, mm-hmm. and go and, you know, buy houses together and, like, you know, install water cannons and jump rope. And swing, right. You know, rope swings, and you know, just you can imagine the house that that 8-9-year-olds. It's a house hunting story. You can imagine the house that 8-9-year-olds would buy if they had like, you know, if they each were making $100,000 a year. Right. So, anyway, they're not all in this story because the main character is actually an artist. So. But what am I trying to say? So, why did I bring this up? The reason I brought this up is because. Yeah. This story was originally part of this project that Frank Wu and Jay Lake put together, which was a bunch of stories that were all linked because or stories and poems and art and plays and so on that were linked because each was a response to the other. So somebody would write a poem and you know, so initially I think it started with Frank Wu's picture. Somebody wrote a It was like it was a variant of that old Exquisite Corpse game that the Surrealists played. Frank Wu would draw a picture. Somebody else wrote like a poem in response to the picture, and then someone without seeing the picture wrote something in response to the poem. You know,
right,
a play.
Would
write a story. In
case any podcast listeners are not familiar with the game, I think the idea was you have a piece of paper and someone would write the first line of a story, and the next person sort of sees that line, writes the second line, and then folds the paper back, so the person after them can only see the second line, not the first.
Right, right.
And you sort of go like that.
Reacting to, there's a whole chain in which each person is only aware of and reacting to the previous,
right.
The previous thing. So, what ended up, what we ended up doing. What's interesting about the story is that I love this story. It's one of my favorite sort of you know speculative idea stories that I've written, and the speculative idea is totally taken from Diana Sherman's play, which I was reacting to, in which deals with she invented the outbreak of the virus that stops aging, and her play takes place at the time of the outbreak. So it's very, very domestic. It's this, you know, this one family, and it's the outbreak happens during this, you know, beach. It's sort of a series of summers at the beach, and you know, they're the family actually is involved in the cause of the outbreak, and so it's this very much, you know, the story culminates with realizing that this is happened. Mm-hmm. And it was very powerful, but you know, that was such a great setup because my immediate reaction, you know, knowing that okay, now I have to write a story in response to this, my immediate thought was okay, so 30 years later, you know,
right,
that was a great setup. And then Marianne Bonraj wrote a poem in response to that, so and then it went on, you know, and it's really neat. It got delayed in terms of by some publication problems. I think it's eventually going to come out, but the story ended up being published in fantasy and science fiction and so on. Anyway, but the reason I go into that long digression is that I think that's sort of a natural mode for art. You know, I think that it is not entirely a, you know, it's not, I'm not very enamored of the romantic idea whereby the poet, you know, sort of looks deeply, you know, Byronically into their dark heart, and they come up, you know, completely originally with something which is, you know, unfettered. To the extent that it's influenced by the society around them, that's a flaw because they need to connect purely to their own individual muse, which is, you know, it's never really made sense to me, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and in fact, I think when I was trying to write like that in high school, according to that model, I just made myself miserable and never produced anything, you know. And I think that having the feeling that writing is this sort of long conversation that is happening with lots of, you know, everything anybody else writes is a resource because you draw on that and you react to it and you're fascinated by it, and you know, it's a non-zero sum game, you know, they give to you and you give back, and that seems like the way it should be. So I was happy to find the whole Creative Commons thing because it seems like a good way to encourage that. Nothing is more fun than having somebody else's take on your story. It's one of the, as we were talking about the Anthropic project, and it's one of the things that's really exciting for me just this past week or so, is people are, you know, these voice actors are turning in these performances where they interpret kind of audiobook style, you know, they're reading these stories, and they it changes the stories totally, which I find totally exciting. I mean, you know, there's a way in which I often write in a mode which is kind of a very distanced fable, like a kind of a, this happened and this happened and this happened. And, you know, the many things are actually on purpose obscured to the reader because, you know, that can, you know, sometimes that's an interesting game to play. That can actually heighten the effect, you know.
Right.
Like in the other cities, a lot of them work by that, the series that was you guys published.
Right. And later
there's a lot of things where it's like you're left going, wait, what was going on there? And and one of the interesting things about that is a lot of time, once you start doing an audio presentation of that, the first things these actors would ask me is, who is speaking and to whom are they speaking? You know, and it's interesting because if you ask that question about the story, it's sort of, the answer is sort of, well, no one. You know, this is narration. You know, this is not. But once someone has to read it, they have to imbue the narrator with a much less abstract personality. So you kind of have to make some decisions, you know. And that was, you know, that became a really interesting thing. And people made really interesting choices about, like, well, who is saying this and to whom are they saying it? So that the works, when they're read aloud, are almost really, you know, they're different stories. Even though they're, you know, giving, in some sense, faithful reproductions, there no words are omitted, but it still is a totally different story than it is on the page. And I love that kind of thing.
Well, you've had a couple stories podcast also, I know, by Escape Pod and other places. And do you get that same sense from the podcast stories?
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly. And it's really interesting to see people's interpretations. A couple of them were podcasts both by Escape Pod and by Beam Me Up, which is another podcast. And their interpretations were wildly different. And I also had a story, Audible.com did a sort of best of stories in fantasy and science fiction. And they did a version of a story from fantasy and science fiction called Red Leather Tassels, which was hilarious. It was much funnier than I had thought the story was when I read it. I love hearing people's, and I've loved the Start the Clock was on Escape Pod, and I really loved the presentation of the narrator. I mean, it was real. She really did a very good, interpretation of this 9-year-old who's 40. You know, that tension of. And they did House Beyond Your Sky too, which was also which they did a good job with too. It's really fun to see. So doing things in Creative Commons makes it possible for people to play with your stuff.
Just a quick note, because of some technical limitations on my end, we are going to have to split the podcast into two parts, and I've decided that this is as good a place as any to split it. So the interview with Ben Rosenbaum, Strange Horizons podcast, will pick up in part two, which should also have been downloaded when you downloaded this part one. So we'll see you there.